Hello and welcome to The Reap Report. I'm your host, Sarah Borks and Keto. Do you know what neurodiversity is and why it's important? Find out during our upcoming ESG Exchange webinar called Neurodiversity in the Reap Workforce. It's taking place April 27th at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and it will feature industry experts talking about what neurodiversity means, why it offers a competitive advantage, and how to create a valuable pipeline for neurodivergent candidates. To register for this free one-hour webinar, visit reit.com/ESG Exchange. That's reit.com/ESG Exchange. And now onto the podcast.
The science is still there. That's really the fundamental indicator to us that the industry is still investing in development. And that really comes back to the late stage clinical pipeline that's driving the whole industry.
Hello and welcome to The Reap Report. I'm your host, Sarah Borks and Keto. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Matt Gardner, CBRE's US life science leader, about some of the key findings from CBRE's latest look into the life science industry. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Sarah. It's nice to be with you.
Can you start by setting the scene for us by describing life science fundamentals coming into 2023?
Yeah, of course. I think what we're looking at for 2023 is a little bit of a hangover of a really long open bull run for the industry. And so I think that's created a really positive afterglow that has led to, I would say, expectations of tremendous upside. It didn't go on forever, though. And so I think we began to see signals that it was slowing down for the whole life sciences sector about a year ago. And then, of course, we saw the small cap of the industry slow down, as well as venture valuations taking a hit during 2022. So as we came into 2023, we were concerned about how that combination of signals might affect the industry's growth. And yet, Sarah, we entered the year experiencing things like all-time highs in industry employment and new product development. And so there are reasons to look at all these signals together and see the same things I think that economists are perplexed by when the economy seems to be slowing down, and yet there are lots of positive signals. Our Outlook report, I think, covers those things very well and goes into a tremendous amount of detail on what those signals mean.
So Matt, with the first quarter now behind us, what are we seeing so far in terms of R&D trends and overall levels of venture capital investment?
It's been such an interesting time to watch these signals. And obviously, some of these things are mixed. But so far this year, we've seen, I think, on the public side of the equation, those small cap public companies continuing to feel that pressure, while we still see record amounts of new venture fund formation. And so in 2021 and 2022, life sciences venture funds established close to $50 billion in new funds. I think about $22 to $23 billion of that was in 2022. And so when you put that together with what we're looking at after Q1, certainly we've seen valuations down, I think slower decision-making by venture investors, but we still see venture activity. While the small cap public end of the industry has been squeezed, we still see venture investing happening. We've continued to push all-time highs in employment, and the Outlook report for 2023 covers that, I think, very well in looking at life sciences employment trends. While the growth rate is slowing down, and at the same time as we see all that happening, the amount that's been invested in the industry over this long bull run that we're talking about, starting in 2015, also left us with an incredible number of products in development, and those are still there. So those are the kinds of signals for us to watch where you can see why the industry doesn't obey the general economic cycle. It takes a long time to develop a life sciences product. And so if a product may take 10 to 15 years to develop, the investment in that product isn't going to follow a seven-year economic cycle, which is why we look at this record of number of products in phase two and phase three clinical trials as such an important sign of the industry's overall well-being. The science is still there. That's really the fundamental indicator to us that the industry is still investing in development. And that really comes back to the late stage clinical pipeline that's driving the whole industry.
And given current market volatility, do you expect to see investors sticking to the tried and tested life science real estate markets?
It's a great question, Sarah. I think what we see is generally a tremendous amount of new investment has occurred over the last 5 years in about the top 15 life sciences markets. the healthiest of those, the most robust growth and investment has occurred in places like San Diego, San Francisco, and Boston. And they'll continue to have the sort of the largest total square footage of life science investment. What we think will happen, and as described in this Outlook report, is that we have a lot of new lab being delivered in this next 2-year period. And so the industry overall is growing from roughly 180 million square feet of lab in the US to about 220 million square feet of lab. And that leap, that sort of 20% growth rate, will actually take a little while to absorb. So it's new square footage arriving in the market at the same time as we see a little bit of a slowdown in economic activity and that absorption rate slowing down. So it'll take a little bit longer even than might have sort of organic growth absorbed that new space. So it might take us 2 to 4 years to see some of that happening. At the same time, Sarah, if I could just point to a completely different trend.
Right.
Because the small cap end of the market is still, relatively speaking, closed, so to speak. So if you're a small publicly traded biotech company, Wall Street, generally speaking, doesn't have the ability to handle a $200 or $300 million follow-on fundraising. Your alternative sources of capital typically are going to come from partnering with multinationals. And so that we expect to be the primarily one of the driving sources of alternate capital for those companies. And so to see those products continue to develop, we'll expect more life sciences companies to partner more frequently with pharma to drive products forward.
And in terms of the up and coming life science real estate markets, do you still see potential for growth in this environment?
Yes, although we obviously, we touched on a moment ago, expecting that some of that growth will slow down. And you sort of alluded to it in your last question that, the flight to safety certainly has an impact here. The thing about sort of life sciences talent, and if you look at the way that we cover talent in this report, it's no different, I would say, in general terms than knowledge workers in the tech part of the economy. In that those types of workers are looking for places that are, amenitized work environments where there's entertainment and dining nearby. And so we tend to see that kind of capacity is growing in the life sciences sector, even in some of those markets that we've identified as emerging. So you'll see that covered in this report, featuring places like Houston and Atlanta. Obviously, established life sciences markets like DC and Philadelphia have tremendous amenities, but there are some additional emerging spaces as well. So I do think we'll see continued growth in new markets, in particular because some of the leaders of the industry have established their positions in the major markets and are thinking about a combination of things, where else they need to be and where else they might find life sciences talent, as we touched on a moment ago. The talent is one of the major factors driving this equation. And if we were to assume for a second that we've filled the amount of hiring we can in the major markets, those questions about emerging markets will continue to be important to the industry on the whole.
Great. And you've already touched upon this earlier, but can you talk a bit more about supply and demand trends and really whether there are any shifts in what tenants are looking for, any special requests they're making, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think obviously there are some general trends in real estate for how the return to office has shaped, a rethink about what we're going to do when we go to work. That's a little bit different in life sciences because life sciences are so much more driven by what's happening in the lab. And so one thing that we have seen a little bit more of is that the underlying factor here is that the lab really never went to sleep or went away during COVID. And so the return to office thing doesn't quite hit life sciences the same way. And so for those companies with a mix of lab and office, the calculus might only be slightly different in that they're looking for ways to emphasize more that the lab is driving culture. And so the more that they might look at consolidating some of those functions around where the lab drives culture, the lab becomes even more important. And so we do see that come into the sort of the calculations and capital planning processes for companies thinking about how many of those kinds of positions they want to maintain. And so that's a really interesting question when you're talking about, multinationals with dozens of locations and how much research they can drive. It turns out to be very interesting that they think of lab as part of the culture. And so we appreciate that may mean that really turns out to be one of the most important amenities to a life sciences company is the lab itself.
Can we talk a bit more about what you're seeing in terms of life science real estate transaction volumes and whether that's been impacted by what we're seeing in the debt markets today?
Well, I think there are a number of questions wrapped together there. First, I think the debt market certainly is, you know, having a slowdown effect. I think the current rate will make debt a difficult question for anybody that it's including in their capital stack. But certainly we also hear at the same time, Sarah, what we talked about a minute ago is that more of the small cap part of the market is saying we can't currently plan to self-finance given the market condition. And so that, like I said a few minutes ago, that leads us to a different set of conversations about what alternative capital partners might look like if debt is not going to be part of the capital stack for more of these projects for growing companies or companies with pipelines that are getting closer to FDA approval, for example, which turns out to be highly important math to them. So I think that the debt market is a real challenge. It's not going to go away anytime soon or until the rate starts to come back down. Transaction volume in general, I think, is down. We were concerned, I think, in Q4 that we might see a bigger uptick in vacancy rates. And it, I think, has turned up a little bit. But as you can see from this report, the large markets are still holding steady. Absorption slowed down a little bit. The other thing that I think is an interesting factor is the subleasing part of the market, which is much more difficult to measure, as you can appreciate. Those kinds of subleasing arrangements don't always hit transparently in the marketplace. So they're a little harder to see, but there are certainly more subleases that appear to be happening in the market as well. So we might expect, especially as all that new square footage is being delivered with slowing absorption and an increase in subleases, that overall vacancy will tick back up while we're slowing down a little bit here. And it might take us until markets are more open to raising capital for that to change.
Great. So really summing up, Matt, what's your broad assessment for 2023? And what should investors really be paying close attention to in the months ahead?
We see a few things happening here, Sarah. If you look at the flows of venture capital that we talked about at the very beginning of this conversation, we do see deals happening. And so we've seen periods like this before when the overall economy has slowed down, but there are still tremendous investments in life science to carry forward. So I think things to watch are particularly what happens to those later stage products. And I think we still see companies partnering. We still see companies able to raise capital. What we might see from this, Sarah, is if we're comparing to other down cycles that the life sciences industry has experienced in 2003 or 2009 and those types of periods, we might see fewer but larger deals. And I think what that possibly means is we might expect venture capital funds to consider portfolio mergers. We might expect there to be fewer, you know, bets in a particular scientific area. Right now, for example, there are lots of natural killer T cell companies out in the ether. And I think at the same time, this year at the JP Morgan Healthcare Conference in San Francisco, there were lots of CD19 business plans. Just one example. But if you look at it that way, it's possible that the venture community will support fewer of those in any given category. And so if we see a little bit of consolidation, a little bit of portfolio merging, that would look a lot more like what we experienced in 2003 and 2009. And I think that might match what we'll see as we get further into this year for fewer venture investments, but that are larger. So more like those large rounds of 100 to 200 million or more. And we certainly have seen a number of those the last 6 to 9 months as well. So we still see investing happening. There still is capital available. But as I said a few minutes ago, for the later stage products in the pipeline, we expect those companies to turn much more often to pharma for partnering opportunities.
Excellent. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sarah, thanks for your time.
And to our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, please subscribe or leave a review on your favorite podcast platform.